one of the things that we found out, and this was not rumor, that gentleman, and I can't recall his name, moved to Seattle, that was on the city council on the grant. And I went out to pick up one of my kids from school, and I walked past him, and then he said, "Bob," and I turned around. I recognized him. He said, "You're about there." I said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And he said, "I'm so unknown." I said, "I remember you, you're the city councilman." He said, "Yeah, I was the one assigned to watch you." And I'm saying, "Pardon?" "Watch me do what?" "Nothing," he said. "Totally innocent. You went for a walk in the evening, you came back home. You didn't go out to meet any girls." And he said, "I was assigned." And I said, "Well, what if we had been picking up girls, what would you have done?" He said, "I would have reported back." And I said, "What would they have done then?" He said, "I don't know."
Make it hot for you.
Make it hot for me. Yeah, yeah, that's all.
But they find a way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you really realize why you didn't do that to that. Sure. Yeah, yeah. But anyhow, these are kind of covert actions, you know, and going on. Not totally freedom. Always that distance between you. You know, when you get a certain age, then you're a threat.
Now, the Ku Klux Klan was active in LeGrand in 1922-23.
Okay.
Did you have any sort of references to
my
that?
My grandmother knew about that. You know, they still burn the L.
Oh, yes. On Table Mountain.
Table Mountain, also where the Ku Klux Klan burned their cross.
Yes.
All right, you know, you were chosen from the school to go up and set the L on fire. I didn't know why my grandmother wouldn't let me go. Then she told me, "I don't want you up there. They used to burn the L up there," and it's just something. So I always respected her. Mm-hmm. I never participated in the ceremony when they were burning the L.
Did she ever say that they were the Ku Klux Klan?
Ku Klux Klan.
She did.
Baker, LeGrand had a large group of them. Now, the little booklet or the pamphlet that was found here, 25 years ago, my uncle was doing some excavating and found that book with the list of the Ku Klux Klan people in them, some surprise names.
Oh, yeah.
In that book.
Oh, yeah.
Surprise.
I know.
That's indeed. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And the strange thing is, some of their sons were my friend.
Mm-hmm.
We were very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the kids were shocked when they found out.
This is just incidentally. Uh-huh. I was interviewing a man named Pat Fitzgerald last week.
Oh, yeah. I know Pat. Yeah.
He was growing up during all this time.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew a lot of the men who belonged to the Ku Klux Klan. And I said, "Well, why do you think they put on these sheets and went up and burned?" "Oh, just a bunch of damn fools."
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, "Well, do you think they didn't know the connection between the Klan and the South?" He said, "I don't think so."
Yes, they did. Because they had migrated their families from the South to Oregon and Washington. So that they were pretty much familiar with the Klan and what they were doing. You know, but some of the younger people may not have known. But those elder people did know. Now, this is just
they
after...
must have.
Yeah. So, see, it was just after World War I. And a lot of these people who used to be in the Armistice Day Parade, well, not a lot of them, but some of them were Klan members. They were friendly and outgoing on the surface. So that makes you really kind of fearful when you look and say, "Wait a minute, you know." Yeah.
Well, I suppose they would say that they thought they were preserving the best values of American democracy.
Democracy. This was something it was ingrained, you know, in them.
They didn't realize how hypocritical it was.
No, they had no idea. They thought they were right. And I love my grandmother because she said, "Well, you know, sometimes when we feel that we're doing the right thing, that we feel it is right, it may not be totally right for someone else." And so she explained to me, she said, "Okay, the people who are in the Klan somehow feel that we are here and we can damage them or take something away from them." She said, "I don't know what the hell we have they can take." She said, if they pointed out to me, I'd sure like to know what it is. So her sense of humor got me through, because I go in having a problem, you know, and she would laugh, you know, and so come up with something. Well, which the president was going to have a pop, chicken in every pot, which one was that?
Harding.
Was it Warren G. Harding?
I think so.
Okay. My grandmother's comment. Mr. Harding said he was going to give us a chicken in every pot. I got a yard full of chickens and a pantry full of pots. What the hell? That's right. Give me something that I don't have.
A little money in the bank.
Yeah, that's the kind of person she was. So she just goes.
Yeah.
So I learned that she had lived and how she had gotten through.
Yeah.
By just taking it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Taking it that way and being able to say, well, no, it's nothing. No. No. Learn to deal with it. Accept those who are friendly, those who are unfriendly. To hell with them. That's exactly what she taught me. So that's kind of my whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can, when I get in there and a person a little icy, just turn it back, go and talk to somebody else. That's what you do. But it was an interesting town. It was a segregated town. There were some sharp differences in, and something I hadn't realized, this Metropolis woman that I told you to check on, Mrs. Metropolis married Angel Metropolis. Now, she was a blonde woman, and I hadn't realized that she was not accepted, not Angel was not accepted, her husband, who was Greek, until I...
Somewhat dark skinned.
Dark skinned, mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I hadn't realized that that they were suffering some of the same thing. Mm-hmm. So she said, in Maxville, you know, we lived right on the border of where all the blacks lived. And then it came to me, when I got the job here in Seattle, I was the first black male hired in the state of Washington to teach. Eula, her daughter, had gotten a job in Klamath Falls or someplace. She ended up writing for cosmetology or something. But I got a nice long letter from Eula, and one of the statements in there was that we showed them, didn't we? And I turned to her, what the heck? But I hadn't realized that she had gone through some of the same kinds of things I did.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't think about it, you know. But she was dark skinned, mm-hmm. a very beautiful girl. Mm-hmm. And she had married the Methodist minister's son, so but that was it. And then I talked to a number of the Rehas who were Hispanic, Ed, who refused to go back to Atlanta. And I said, why? He says, well, you don't know how I was treated. And I'm thinking, big, handsome guy, you know, just kind of olive skin. And most of the kids I had, girls I knew, went gaga over it, you know, and I went, Bob. He said, that was just some of the things. He said, but you don't know how our family was really treated. And I said, no. I said, I have an idea. I grew up in the neighborhood. There were the Aceless, who spoke Spanish. The Tomalinkoviches. Zigoviches lived in the neighborhood. The Cedars. Now, they were loggers also, but they worked for Mount Emily. They occupied their housing, and as they moved on, kind of like Jewish people moving out and now blacks moving in. In LeGrand, it was the Slavic people moving out and blacks were occupying it. So the homes that we lived in were built by the first people who came in from Yugoslavia and Germany and what have you. But I grew up with their kids. Those are my kids that I played with. And but Tim, I knew curse words in about five languages, you know, that I've forgotten, you know. Because you go to the Aceless and she'd be screaming and yelling at
yeah.
We knew when to move. But we were all good friends. Okay, so they... All right, I was in Portland, walking down the street, and this very tall man stopped me and said, Terry? I said, yeah. And he said, Tom Zivic. And I'm looking at him. I'm saying, said, I live right behind you. I said, no, the Zygovitz, oh, okay. The Zygovitz live behind us. They shortened the name. And I said, was the Fritzy Zivic, who was the championship prize fighter, was that the one, that the Fritzy we knew, that was Fritzy Zygovitz? He said, yeah, we shortened it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I know him. He says, well, of course you know me too, you nuts. Jermolowski's always people, you know, they were, the people came in and they had faced some of the same kinds of biases that we faced. But the thing is, they were sometimes more biased than the people who grew up in the country. And it was something that's kind of interesting to watch that economy that you see.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was getting the impression from Dorothy that all was sweetness and light, pretty much, between people of all races in LeGrand.
When Dorothy moved to LeGrand in 1946, she was an adult. Her associations were with people, adult people.
And of course, she was still very busy with a lot of children.
And she had a house full of children.
A little isolated.
She was isolated. Yeah. Women don't have that exposure that men have.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, she's sheltered. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially teenage boys.
Yeah.
Will get it.
Yeah.
On.
Yeah. You should have interviewed her eldest son. You'll get a tough story.
I'll bet.
Yeah. Grew up in LeGrand. He's retired now, colonel, army, and they've done pretty well with their grandchildren. You know, she probably told you that one of her grandsons is an attorney in Oregon.
No, she didn't mention that.
Yeah, and he was in Portland in a big firm, and he didn't like working in a firm. So he's at one of the little towns there, and I'm wondering, you know, how he's getting along. But he is mixed, you know, his mother's white, so he's very fair-skinned. And that's something else.
That's the son who's the brakeman?
Yeah. His son is an attorney.
Yeah. She told me about that son and his wife, former wife, they're both living in LeGrand.
Well, this is something that you realize, too, that if you're a fair skin, you're accepted a little bit better than the darker skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people realize that.
Yeah.
That happens. Yeah, but it is. It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when I came to Seattle, there was a young man here named King. And he said, how in the hell did you ever get hired? I've been applying. I have a master's degree. I've done this and that. And I said, I found out how I got hired. Our superintendent of school was named Patton. And I've been working 2 years here, and we were over at the administration building one Christmas. Had a group of our kids were caroling, and Sam Fleming came up and stood beside me and said, well, it turned out really well. I'm looking at him. I said, okay. He said, Patton and I were roommates, college, and when you applied for a job here, we got this really great letter. And I said, you didn't look at my transcript. Well, I didn't have the higher grade, but I did okay. He said, no. He said, but he said you were a good guy. And he was my closest friend. And that had a bearing on why I got hired. And Brennan was here, but Brennan was very dark skinned. He finally was hired, ended up being one of the best football coaches they had around. But we realized that. Yeah. And it's just unfortunate that all this happened. But let me go back now. Okay, LeGrand, from John's Kitchen all the way to Maxville, back to LeGrand, back to Greenwood School, the Central School. And I was lucky enough to get into good classes. I had some really fine teachers. I was surprised that a number of them had graduated from Eastern Oregon Normal. My first and second grade teachers they only had 3-year degrees, you know. The normal school, that's all they had to have. And I think, the third grade before I had someone with a baccalaureate degree. And Ronald Walk was my, I thought he'd be teaching me forever. It was my seventh grade, and I got junior high was there. Didn't even have to be in principal for high school. I'm doomed, you know. But I guess when they sit in for recommendations, when I signed up to go into service, he had filled out some papers, and he had neglected to put my race down. He didn't even think about it. And I was going through this line, and the guy said something, and he got up and went back in the room, and they asked me, "No, you run a word over in the other room." They were sending me through the white processing line. Whoops! Ooh! I went back and I told him. He said, "Oh God, Bob, I'm sorry." I said, "No, don't worry about that. If they didn't look at me, they would have been blind. You know, I'm left blind." He says, "I didn't even think about marking it." Well, that's the way he was. You know, he was really nice. But these are the things. I think there were several people who, in my life, that were very, very, very supportive and helped. I lost my dad and mom when I was 2 years old. Grandmother had to be responsible for trying to rear a child after all her family had gone. And now I realize what she had to go through. You know, a rambunctious kid, you know, who was going. And here she is, probably in her mid-40s. When she had to take, after all her five kids are gone, you know, she's got another little one too. Yeah. She faced another 20 years, you know, of rearing.
What encounters did you have with Mormons during your early years?
Well, as I said, one of my best teachers and greatest supporter, I didn't know was Mormon until I had graduated from college.
Oh, you weren't aware when you were a teenager that Mormons existed there?
Oh, I know Mormons existed. Yeah. But I had somehow I hadn't realized that he was a Mormon. We used the Mormon gym for all our practice. We knew everything. And some of our best friends, the Weston schools, all of them, they were just good friends.
Mm-hmm. The subject never came up.
Huh. Never came up. And I was kind of surprised later on in life. And I thought, oh, they were all very cordial, good. We went to their homes. And I will tell you, Ronald Walk was Mormon. And he was one of the, and he was the person who probably did more for me than any other single teacher. And I wonder how he did the Mormon gym and everything. He had access to it. And I didn't realize that Ronald was Mormon. And And the Western schools, and oh, good Lord, I know how many that we would get us, and a whole bunch of people that I played with. Nope, religion never came up.
Well, you said you went around visiting all the various churches.
I visited
the Mormons?
The LDS.
You did?
Yes.
Oh. Did they invite you to become a member?
No. No. I would not ask to join the group. No.
Okay.
No. No, I didn't. I'm not asked to go to Sunday school there. I did at the Baptist. I did.
Well, that should have cued you some way.
Well, I don't think you think about it. No. You don't think about it. No. I don't think it. No. No, I'd grown up and then I realized, my God, you know, I remember risking my life. No. No, they were good people. Great. But not, they had this belief, you know, that we were less than human, I guess. For a while there.
Well, when the war came along, you were just about eligible to be drafted, weren't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that what happened?
I joined the Navy.
On your own?
Mm-hmm.
Before they could get you in the Army?
I got my notice. Greetings.
Yes. That's a familiar dodge. I've heard that story before.
And I was kind of saddened that I was left out of the 13 young people who left on that Kerry and Russell and all those. See, I was one of those. But my name is not in the group. I left at the same time.
No, I'm not sure what you're telling me here.
Just a moment. Oh, we left with that group. Stockton Boyd made a killing then. He was a naval recruiter. And he had about 15 recruits just went and all went into service at the same time before they finished. Now we had another year to go.
You were discharged as soon as the war ended then?
Yeah.
Or shortly after?
Well, 8-10 months after.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was on Okinawa when the war ended. Yeah.
In fact, did you decide to come right back to the Grand?
I came back, and we were going, I was slated to go to the University of Oregon.
On a football scholarship?
We went down, I got the letter to come down. And we went down, and very graciously. And then they said, we will try to find housing for you. And I'm going, okay, we've got quite a lot of dorms with you. Not allowed to live in the dorms at that time. Mm-hmm. Just about 4 months before the vets dorms came up, being, let's see, what, 19, just before my 20th birthday, maybe I was 20 before my 21st birthday, yeah. A little hot-headed, and I figured if you can't find a place for me to live, screw you. So I went back and went to Eastern Oregon. Mm-hmm. And stayed with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And happy that I did.
From 46 to 50?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I imagine you have a lot to say about the time at the college. It must have felt different in many ways from high school.
Oh, quite different. I think...
Did you immediately turn out for the various athletic teams?
Not the first year.
No?
No. No. I had to get my feet wet.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Were you a little apprehensive about undertaking college work?
No.
No.
No. Didn't have enough sense to be a...
Well, or plenty of confidence. I guess you'd had a chance to demonstrate your abilities.
Yeah, so anyway, got into the program, and then turned out for football the second year,
mm-hmm.
and ran track. And we didn't have a successful football season. We didn't have the kind of players mm-hmm. that you need mm-hmm. in order to have a successful mm-hmm. football
season. And they weren't importing players from Seattle at that time.
No, they weren't importing players. No, they were... People coming to school to get the 2-year degree and
sure.
go on to the university or to complete there and become a teacher.
Was it your idea to become a teacher at that
point? No, I wanted to be a dentist.
Huh.
And I got into the school and I met...
You were taking lots of science then?
I took some science, yeah. And was disappointed in a couple of the classes. And then I got into Dr. Badgley's class. And I figured... Boy, I wish I had gotten here the first year.
Yeah.
Oh, what a difference. And I figured, well, I would have majored in this if I had this man teaching me.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Right.
Oh, it's a difference in the teaching, mm-hmm. the quality of teaching.
Yes.
But Batch was a good teacher. We were fantastic teacher.
And really devoted to that college.
Oh, loved it. He could have gone any place in the country
yeah.
to
yeah.
teach. And he devoted, but both of them were there, you know. She taught biology. Yeah, and it was for the... I got her because she was the one who taught for those who were going to teach in elementary school. We had to take that science.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was Ronald Locke again, who was principal over at the high school. I went over there, you know, went to look, you know, with what to go up to our practice teaching, so I went to see if I could get over there. And he says, what you need to do is to get elementary and secondary. He said, because if you go in and have a job advertised for X teacher, and you get in there and you send in your credential. And I said, well, they have the same picture. He said, yeah. But you'll get there, and then they'll question you, and they'll say, well, we just fill that position. So just tell them, well, I can teach fourth grade, too. That's what he said. I came to Seattle and interviewed, and they said, oh, we'll let you know. Okay. I got back home. I had a letter from San Francisco also in Los Angeles. And so I said, well, I'm going to find it. And then about 2 days later, I got this note from Seattle. That yeah, we found a spot. Would you mind teaching at the eighth grade and a school also is for special students? And I said no. Well, I got there and these were deaf students, and it was fascinating to work in that program. I never did learn to sign, but I had a number. And I was the only male in the building, other than the principal. And so the elderly lady said, "Would you teach our PE?" So we can't go up and down those steps. We will do your art and something else. And I said, "Great, you know, they have music on there for me to teach in no way." But I said, "Well," they look at a transcript and they see, "Oh, you've taken this, this, and this." I said, I took that music course because I had to have it to get an elementary certificate. I'm not a musician. I said, "Well, you got a good grade in it." I said, "Yeah." You can teach them to sing.
What was your preferred field of teaching?
I wanted to really get into psych.
Well, I mean, when you started out.
Well, when I started out.
In the public schools.
In the public schools? Yeah. Well, I loved history. I loved biology. I liked science things, too. But, like, I got a history class. Finally got through to do the history. That was fun.
When Seattle Schools hired you, though, what academic areas did they expect you to teach?
They thought I would go to a high school, and I would need history. And if I went into elementary school, you teach everything that's on the book.
Sure.
Yeah, so, yeah. But history would have been my area.
Assuming that you would also coach?
Yeah, yeah. This was the assumption.
Yeah.
Because my goal then was to become a football coach. You know, to get the class to be a football coach. Came in, got keyed. One of the guys who was coaching, he said, "Bob," he said, "you get on that list." And he says, "You will probably be a grandfather before they get to you." He said, "That's kind of an incestual thing in this coaching field. That if you notice the people who are coaching now, well, their grandfather's coached back there somewhere. And then their dad, now they're there."
The railroad worked that way too, I understand.
Yeah.
Especially if you wanted to be an engineer.
Yeah, and that's it. And I thought, I kind of looked at it and I started asking questions. And I found out, this was the son of the person who coached there before. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Unless you have that kind of inroad," he says, "no matter what you do or how well you coach," he said, "if you're lucky enough to get in there and become friends and become the assistant, then maybe after 10 or 12 years, until I'll be old and gray, we'll be able to move." So. But anyhow, so that's when I got into that and I watched these teachers who I thought were geniuses to work with that type of student, with deaf students, and working and watching the injury, how they effort to work with them. And then I transferred into another building, and these were academically challenged students, a real task. Wondered why I got there, but I think it taught patience, and you had to teach.
Mm-hmm.
You had to teach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had to have patience and you had to go over it and back and forth. So it did teach me a lot. And then I realized, you know, that a good teacher really has to devote himself almost 100% to that student.
Where did you say you had student taught while you were at LeGrand?
Ackerman.
At Ackerman?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Hill and Mrs. Eva Ware.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. So you taught for what? Two quarters?
Two quarters. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I had Hill, who was the seventh grade,
mm-hmm.
and Ware was fourth, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I had both. Yeah. So I could get both, mm-hmm. both areas. That was because of Ron Watt. He said that you do it, you get the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that you, when you go apply for a job, you can teach at any level, and that's what
sure.
I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have discussions with Ms. Ware and Mr. Hill about where you might teach after you left LeGrand?
No. Let me tell you something that I was surprised. Martha Addy was the advisor. She was over the teaching.
I took a course with her, too.
Okay. All right. Martha took me aside just before graduating and said, "Bob, probably you're going to have to teach in the South. Probably not be anything for you in this part of the country."
Martha was from the South, wasn't
Martha,
she?
Martha, she and Dr. says, you're probably, I said, why didn't you tell me that before I signed up? When you first interviewed me and put me into the program, why didn't you tell me, well, if you get become certified, you will have to go south? Mm-hmm. I said, I'm not going to teach in the south. And I didn't think anything of it. I still supplied everyone I got down here.
Did you question her at all about
No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. I just said, well, no, I'll try my hand at someplace else before, and that's the last resort. Well, I didn't think anything else of it. Well, I figured, well, you know, they are hiring, and I've been reading about the seven women, black women, who had been hired in Seattle. And I knew one of them who had lived in Ellensburg, you know, when we moved. Seven or eight years ago, I was down at Salem visiting a friend. We had a party, all the people around the area that had been in Eastern Oregon that were in Salem and down in that part, he had invited them in, Lou DiLoretto was his name. And so he called me and said, okay, I got a bunch of the gang, that was the EOC as we call it then, to come down and we're going to get together. So I went down there and it was fun meeting all these people that I hadn't seen in years. They were all teachers. And I was talking to someone and I overheard Alice saying, well, when I got ready to leave Eastern Oregon, Dr. Addy told me I probably would not be able to get a teaching job. She was Japanese because of the war, and he went through this whole thing. So I went over and she didn't mention the name who had told her that, and I said, you talked to Dr. Addy too, didn't you? He said, well, yeah. I said, she told me the same thing. We started laughing. I said, I wonder what you'd think if you came down to Salem and drove down by the Alice Wada Middle School. Touché.
Well, things have changed.
Well, things have changed. Superintendent of schools. She's not going to get a chance. I think Alice would have passed out if she'd ever gotten a B. I'd just been dead, you know. Never know anything but A's. Just the brightest thing in the world, you know, and really a great, great person.
How did a Japanese student get to LeGrand those days?
Oh, those days, you know, there was a lot of labor going on in the area through Yakima, and they came in to LeGrand from Yakima, from the farm area. She was from Yakima originally, and had been, she and Carl Isiri had been part of the internment. Hmm. Yeah.
What did she have to say about how she was treated in LeGrand?
Very well.
Other than by what Martha Addy told her.
Well, I think probably when you're confined to a college environment and you don't have to do too much association with the city at large, you're living in a very special community of people in a dorm who are friends and yeah. And I think that was it. You're really sheltered. Yeah, you're sheltered in this environment.
Even so, I think in those earlier days, many of the students at Eastern Oregon College had the reputation of being pretty narrow-minded when it came to social values.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
Including the president at the time. It's horrified and angry. I was vice president of the student body at Eastern, and we were in a meeting, and the student body officers and the editor of the paper and a bunch of students who were on the student government. And this gentleman got up and told a darkie joke. Then he realized I was sitting there. And
was it appropriate to anything? Just out of the blue?
Out of the blue. Just out of the blue. Then he turned five shades of red because he forgot that there was a black person sitting in there. He just not accustomed to it.
Did he apologize?
He tried. He tried. I never could. No, I was glad when he went to the hospital. No, I will never forget that. As long as and Jimmy was just beside, he said, should we write it up? And I said, forget it. You know, been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And since we are not, you know, we're not here all the time, he's never had a black person on student government. Yeah.
You were living with your grandmother, but I suppose you went to businesses of various kinds in McGrath.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So as an adult, did you perceive any other uncomfortable kinds of reactions?
I think probably one of the reasons I didn't, many of the places I went, by the time I had gotten to college level, the sons and daughters were running the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already attended high school and two or three years of college.
So they greeted you as an old friend.
A little old buddy, you know.
Yeah, sure,
so that,
sure.
So I don't know how that would have been if I had gone.
Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
You obviously had an advantage.
I had an advantage, and that was one of the things I had a great advantage of.
Would you like to talk a little bit about the place of Lafayette Lucky Trice in the Grand business community?
All right, the business
also
community.
Also, he was in the Veterans of Foreign Wars and American Legion, wasn't he?
Yeah, head of the American Legion. First
he was
first.
Very active in conservation efforts, I read.
Extremely, yeah. Well, one of the things that you have to realize, here is a man who I always wondered what would happen if he had been able to get a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
But where would he
have gone? Lots of ability.
Tremendous amount of ability. A very bright person with very limited education, except he did not perform as someone who had been denied. I guess when you're thinking of education, I think you're thinking of the formalized type. No, but well educated. He was unearthly, adventurous, trying anything.
Mm-hmm.
He was just curious, you know. And my grandmother said he'd always been that way as a kid, you know, he wanted to know how things worked, and he was good at doing it. And one of the reasons he got jobs, because his dad could repair almost anything, and they taught him that. So anytime they got jobs in the log jam, see, my grandfather ran the skidder and stuff, and when he ran the loader, they loaded the logs on the train. And so Lucky learned all these things, and he learned how to repair the bulldozer and all that, so he knew how to do this. So he was in demand.
Sure.
He never had to take a job of menial labor.
But yet he did menial labor.
But he did, in LeGrand, he did.
Yeah.
Pride.
Mm-hmm.
He always wanted to work, he said, for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did. All right, I said, but you're cleaning a building. He said, but I'm in that building all along. Nobody bothers me. I wax the floor, I clean it, I get praised for that. See, that's all. Now all I want is money. He had a shoe shine parlor. He had a hat blocking thing. He had a race car thing. He was always trying to build something. I worked with him in Baker. That's where he lived most of the time, before Dorothy met him. And what he had done, he'd made a business. You know the oil tankers that run back and forth?
Cars?
No, the big tankers that carry gas and oil. And,
yeah.
Okay.
You mean the railroad?
No. These are on the highway. The
trucks.
The big trucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. They get stress fractures in those big tanks. He started a business where what he would do when they have to be repaired. You don't get a new one. If they had a little crack in it, you know, they have to have it repaired. So what you have to do is you have to steam that thing for a couple of days to get all the gas fumes out. Then you go inside and weld it. Well, he set up a welding shop and a station to clean those things. I went over to help him clean them. He would never let me go inside the well because he said it's too dangerous. I'm like, well, you're in it, you know. But he would clean them, and then he'd get inside the tank, and then he'd weld these little cracks. I could do the welding on the outside. But that he started it up, he had that, and he ran, then he sold that, and he came to LeGrand after the war, and he sold that business to someone. But he, at times, he would have as high as five tankers sitting in that lot that he had to repair, and he got paid well for it. Yeah. Yeah. And he was always kind of thrifty.
Is there any truth to the idea that, and this was in the newspaper, he got the name Lucky because he was so lucky at cards?
Yeah, but it wasn't luck.
That's what I suspected.
I happened to find up in the attic at Grandma's house some of his lucky cards. Yeah.
Mark?
They were special decks that had, well, on the back of them, there would be, the little diamond would be out of, be a little askew on the back where he had the little line. And I thought, okay. Now, I flipped that over. Okay, well, that's the Ace of Hearts. Okay, that's what I put in my hand. He ordered them from some company. They were already set up. But he could play with the straight deck, too. See, one thing he didn't do, he didn't drink. And he would set up the table. He'd just tell them, bring more. That's why he was lucky.
It helps to have your fellow players a little bit careless.
Just a little inebriated. Just a little, a little nip.
Why do you think he didn't drink?
Grant, his dad was an alcoholic. My grandfather died at 52. And the thing that happened, peritonitis. Now, one of the things that I found out, they had a lot of stills, and they were drinking moonshine. Now, one of the things that some of the moonshiners would do in order to get their wares to market, they would fortify them with lye and get them so they could get it out and sell it. And evidently, he got a hold of a pint that had been laced with lye that was, yeah, and it ate through with a, yeah. Yeah, my grandmother told me that. And I think probably that was one reason that he went to a party once, and I think he had probably a half a beer. He started singing. He says, well, if it makes you act that crazy, what? No, just didn't drink.
So I gather that his success with people and with businesses in LeGrand was a combination of his ingenuity.
In
working for himself.
Yeah.
And probably he was very affable.
Very affable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, liked everybody, or?
Well, they all liked him. Yeah. And he had all these buildings that he had that he cleaned. He had, I forgot how many. Oh, God. I think all the major office buildings, I don't know how he got them, but he had them. So he would dole them out, mm-hmm. and then he would get the money back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when he did. Because I cleaned a couple of them when I was in college to make extra money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which veterans organization was it he was in? There was a picture of him in the newspaper in uniform. Was it the American Legion?
American Legion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was it at all unusual for him to be invited into that organization?
Well, when we first, the American Legion was always open. The veterans of foreign wars didn't want to accept us.
Okay.
Yeah. The American Legion, not the most gracious, but they were willing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
did
no.
Did he have an officer position?
He was a non-commissioned officer.
I mean, an officer in the American Legion.
Oh, yeah, he became the whatever their top person is.
That's what I
expected. Yeah, that was the change from the time from 1946 until 60, 70.
Mm-hmm.
That was that breakaway in the change. And,
yeah.
And the other thing is that the young people that were now American Legion people were kids he had known.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I went back and they said, well, this person, well, I was in grade school with the guy who was now there. Yeah. So he knew him.
Mm-hmm. What accounts for his activity in conservation efforts? His interest in fishing?
Fishing, yeah. And he was really upset, you know, if they open up. And he wanted restrictive fishing.
But was that at a time when there was some sense that fishing runs were endangered?
Yeah. And one of the things that he was concerned about was the... And I was kind of surprised when he came out with that little article about the Indian having total rights to fish at any time, even when there was endangerment of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how can you do that? when your grandmother was half Indian. He said, it had nothing to do with it. If I were a poor one-handed one with headgear, I would still say, John, you can't fish in that one, the salmon are low. It's way he was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was he basing this opinion just on what he observed, or do you think he had studied some of the science?
He had studied some. He had studied it. He was a strange person. And I always kidded him. You could ask him a question, and if he couldn't answer it, if you asked him the next day, he could tell you everything. Because he'd read it. And I said, why didn't you go to school? I didn't have time. I had to help Dad, you know. He went to work at 14.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a waste. Yeah.
And then he was in the Air Force. 3 or 4 years.
He was just at the maximum age where he would not have been able to sign up. Now, 6 months later, he wouldn't be able to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and he worked up there, master sergeant, whatever that is, sergeant major, whatever they're called, in the Air Force.
And he would have been eligible for the GI Bill, surely.
Yeah. Never.
But he didn't?
No. No, he said, I have to go back too far.
Yeah.
See, eighth grade is...
Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, and, you know, 70 years ago in the eighth grade, this is going to cut it. He said, I can't get in a regimented. I could learn it if they just let me do it, but they can't give me a time frame
mm-hmm.
and then give me a mark thing on how well I did on it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't deal with that, you know. Did you know what we graded? He said, hell no.
What might be the most significant achievements that he made in the conservation field?
I was away, so I read about it also. I don't know. I was surprised that he was that vocal. I know that he had always fished and had always hunted. But see, we lived in Maxville, and there was no season. If you ran out of Vincent, you just walked down by the spring and hit one.
Yeah.
And I, as a kid, didn't know there were seasons. Pheasants and deer and quail and all that, you know, were there.
They were probably more loosely observed anyway in those times.
Yeah, but I don't think in the 30s they were plentiful, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you never killed more than
unlimited
you could eat.
Supply.
So, yeah, well, no, just boom, and you know, the deer would dress it out and hang it up and cure it. When that was gone, you'd shoot another. But I grew up in that kind of an environment, and I hadn't realized, you know, that there was restriction on it. And I remember the first time I ordered, what was it, pheasant on the glass when I was out eating, and about died when they brought the check. I used to eat that every day, you know. So I thought, well, I didn't realize we were poor, but we were eating quite well.
Yeah.
And that was something. When my grandmother had a garden, and we had chickens, and each year they would buy a little Peter pig and raise it up and slaughter it in the winter. So, and she has, we have plenty of food.
I haven't heard of anybody in Union County who went through the Depression period and was hungry.
No, actually, the house was tagged, you know, the railroad. You have people going west one day looking for jobs, and then the next day you got a whole way of freight train mm-hmm. coming. And they knew they could get off and go to Aunt Ella's house for a meal. But you had to chop wood first.
Yeah.
So she got all her winter wood chopped. Yes? No. She says, no, don't ever just give it away. No, we've always had it. He said they feel better about it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was one of the things that I learned.
So these were family sometimes?
No, generally just individuals. Yeah.
Men.
Yeah. And occasionally you get a family coming through.
Yeah.
And we had a family, I don't know where they came from, it reminded me of the story with Henry Fonda and the Dust Bowl. What was that thing?
Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath. This family really reminded me. And they moved
the Jones.
In. Yeah, the Jones. They moved in the next door, and they had a disabled child, blind. And they were really poor. And my grandmother fed them for about 4 months to help them get on their feet. And then I, yeah.
Fed them and housed them?
Mm-hmm.
Did you give them a room?
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You, are we supposed to get ready to go? Oh, I guess we are, aren't we?
Yeah.
The game starts at 7.